This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have the return of the Across the Pond segment, a clip from Gamma President and CEO Pete Bunce's presentation at the Cirrus Conference, interviews from CES 2018 on the Bell Helicopter Autonomous Air Taxi, as well as on additive manufacturing for aerospace applications, and the fifth installment from student pilot Nikki on her second solo. In the news, a U.S. company helps develop general aviation in China, a Virgin Galactic gets closer to its first customer flight, Boeing reveals a hypersonic successor to the SR-71 Blackbird, Costa Rica's Civil Aviation Agency suspends a carrier, and the future of the A380. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 486 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian who blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hey, how is everyone this evening, or this show? Looking forward to a quick and enjoyable show because I've got a bit of a flu.
Oh, dear. Everyone's sick. Brian Coleman is also here, our associate producer. Brian, you're just back from CES, and I hear that just about everybody that goes to that show ends up getting sick.
Yeah, and fortunately, I have not been sick. But first of all, Happy New Year, everyone. I wasn't here last week and didn't have a chance to wish you guys and all our listeners a Happy New Year, and that's important to me. So Happy New Year, everyone.
Great. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase the Cirrus aircraft. Other Max, Max West, how are you?
I am back. I can't believe it, but it's been at least 3 weeks. I have just been so incredibly busy over the holidays. I literally flew 8 hours a day every day over the holidays and took off only Christmas and New Year. So it's crazy, but you know, there are worse things that could happen than having to fly every day.
Yeah, great way to spend the time off.
Totally.
Also with us is Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, evening to everybody. And for those of you that didn't hear it before, Happy New Year as well.
Yes. All right. Well, we do not have a guest this episode, but we do have a lot of other interesting segments from the co-hosts, from contributors. So why don't we get started first with the news? Is everybody ready?
Ready.
Oh, yeah.
Ready from the West.
Our first news story comes from thedailybulletin.com. This is Chino Aviation Group wins contract to help Chinese develop general aviation industry. Now, Threshold Aviation Group has partnered with a Chinese company. This is YXST Aviation Industry Development Company Limited, and they're going to establish and operate training centers for Chinese pilots and mechanics. They're going to establish air parks and fixed base operations. Threshold Aviation Group, based in Chino, California. Are you California guys familiar with Threshold?
I'm not familiar with Threshold, but I certainly know where the Chino Airport is.
And I certainly know what kind of airplane all of those folks are standing around there. A really gorgeous late model Cirrus SR-22T.
And I can tell you that it's daytime in the picture.
Exactly.
Such insightful comments. All right, so
I know, huh?
Threshold Aviation Group, they are an aircraft maintenance, management, service, and support organization. They say they have more than 175,000 square feet of hangar and office space. And as we mentioned, they're located at the Chino Airport, KCNO. The Threshold CEO and owner, Mark DiLullo, says, this is a huge, literally huge opportunity for Threshold Aviation Group to expand its business with nearly limitless potential. The Chinese aviation market has the potential to eventually be the largest general aviation market in the world, and we are in on the ground floor of providing that critical service to help get it off the ground. The Chinese company, YXST, it's hard to say that. It's an acronym for something, but they're going to be sending some Chinese pilots and mechanics to the U.S. to Threshold for some training in general aviation skills. They say in their on their website that YXST focuses on the full value chain development, which integrates general aviation services, tourism, aviation education, aircraft sales and maintenance, development of aviation town, aviation medical service, aviation sport, aviation logistics, security service, and extension service. So they obviously offer a lot of different services. So it's interesting that Threshold is going to play a role here, it seems, in these activities to help build the Chinese aviation market. We see that happening on a lot of fronts, not the least of which is Chinese buying of U.S. aviation companies.
And lots of pilot training going on here as well. I had a gentleman contact me recently who is in the Atlanta area. He said he signed up at a flight school. He paid the entire cost up front to get his private. And he said a couple of weeks had gone by and they still had not assigned him a flight instructor. And he said that every time he went down there, it appeared that they had Chinese students everywhere. And the company said, yep, that's true. Most of our clients are here from China. So there's all kinds of activity going on here.
Yeah, and it certainly seems like Threshold has the resources or skill set that they're offering that the Chinese can really benefit from. I'm curious from a business standpoint, if they're looking at this opportunity just to make their money by providing the service, or if they're going to get any sort of long-term revenue share off of this. Yeah, because there's certainly one thing, I think, setting up an airport and getting everything all up and running. But to me, a much bigger play would be that long-term revenue share. Mm. So the terms of the business deal intrigue me over this.
Yeah. And of course, if you can repeat it over and over, because as we know, the aviation infrastructure in China is quite undeveloped, and that's especially true of general aviation there. So the size of the land mass, the size of the population suggests that we could be looking at an awful lot of airports being developed. And I would assume that would take years and years to do. So Threshold isn't the only company doing some things with China in this regard, but they've been active. They had, I think last year in 2016, I think they had, I don't know if you wouldn't call it a conference, I don't think, but some kind of an event with representatives from China to try to develop the relationship. And it looks like, I guess, that paid off with this deal that we're reading about now.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see how this works out. I mean, there are so many U.S. companies that have tried to make an inroad into China over the years that I don't quite... Doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of details here about what they're really doing that is any different, say, from what Max just mentioned about a flight school that had a bunch of students from China already as part of the mechanism. So I'm not quite sure how that all kind of pans out when it goes back to China, though. But I guess we'll wait and see.
Yeah, yeah. Having done business with Chinese companies, there's, I think, a couple of things that many Western or U.S. Specifically companies don't take into consideration, not the least of which is the different culture, not only the culture of the people, but a different business culture. And you can't just walk into China and assume that the methods that you've used in the past are going to be successful there. And then the other issue is language. A lot of Chinese don't have English competency to any great level, that could be an issue. If you're in the cities, of course, then that's not so much a problem, but especially when you get out into the more rural areas where you might want to create some general aviation capability, that can be a big problem. So, yeah, like I say, Rob, it'll be interesting to watch. I think we'll be seeing lots and lots of this sort of thing going on in the coming months and years. Next up, we have from express.co.uk, space tourism in months. Virgin Galactic completes groundbreaking test flight. Of course, we know Virgin Galactic is trying to develop a capability where commercial customers, paying customers, could take suborbital flights. And we see that the VSS Unity plane has been involved in some flight tests, Rob.
What is it? What do you guys think that VSS is? That Virgin spaceship?
You know, that's a good question because I actually tried to find out and I came up dry. That's a great guess.
I was going to try and really impress everybody with that, but then I lost. I noticed in the story it calls the mothership the VMS. So Virgin Mothership. So maybe it is Virgin Spaceship. So we'll see. But anyway, it's pretty cool. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt. I mean, I had always hoped that when they were putting all these various and sundry folks onto the space shuttle years ago, scientists and teachers and doctors and all kinds of things, that they'd finally say, you know what, we need a volunteer from a journalist. And I figured I'd be right there, and that never happened. Yeah, so I'm going to play my cards right this time and make sure I get a ride on this sucker. And I think it would be pretty cool.
It would be. So what we saw here was a successful glide test flight. And this was over the Mojave Desert. And this Unity, this is really the second Spaceship Two space plane. The first one, of course, the Enterprise, was destroyed in that crash back in October 2014. It's hard to believe that it was that long ago. The Unity has made a couple of flight tests over the Mojave Desert since last August, but this was a glide test, and I think there's more tests to come. I think the glide test, this was from an altitude of 50,000 feet, I think.
That's right. They're saying that it was designed to kind of prove out some of the work they've been doing over the last 4 or 5 months, kind of readying this machine for powered flight tests. But I'm no engineer, so I don't quite know what that means exactly.
Hey, Rob, if you had the opportunity to go on one of these coasting reentry flights, would you even do that, or do you want to wait for the whole shebang?
Oh, no, I'd do this. I mean, in a heartbeat. I mean, so long as I didn't have to pay the $275,000 for the ticket. I don't think I quite, maybe one of you guys have seen it. I'm not quite sure how long the flight is supposed to last.
Would that matter to you?
Well, for $275, I mean, I'd like to be up there for longer than 5 minutes.
I think it's about 10 minutes at the most.
Yeah, probably it's short.
It's enough for you to experience weightlessness and see the curvature of the Earth before you come back down.
Not for $275.
Well, apparently 700 people are in on this and have purchased tickets. I think it's interesting that Stephen Hawking is among those ticket holders, which I think that's appropriate.
I think Stephen was gifted one.
Oh, is that right? Well, he deserves to go.
Well, yeah. They took him up in the Vomit Comet so he could experience weightlessness.
Yes.
I think Sir Branson are we are all one step removed from Sir Branson, because we know that our young cohort that has disappeared off the planet used to have relationships and conversations and interviews with Sir Branson. But I'm pretty sure that Stephen is going to go up for free. I think there's a couple of other people that they've been offered the ride to, but if anybody deserves it, it's Hawking.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Speaking of going really fast, we have an article from Popular Mechanics. This is actually a rewrite of an Aviation Week article, but that tends to go behind the paywall. So if you're not a subscriber, you won't be able to see that. But the Popular Mechanics version of the story covers a lot of it. We'll have links to both those in the show notes. But this is Son of Blackbird. Boeing reveals hypersonic concept that could replace the SR-71. Well, this was from a recent forum, an American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics SciTech forum, and Boeing unveiled this reusable Mach 5 Plus concept model. And it's seen as a hypersonic successor, perhaps, to the SR-71 Blackbird. It has delta wings, a twin tail. It's in kind of a wave rider configuration. It looks a bit, David, like the Lockheed Martin SR-72 concept that we saw a few years ago.
Exactly. Hypersonic aerodynamics for Lockheed and hypersonic aerodynamics for Boeing to meet the same requirements probably are going to make aircraft look pretty much similar. So it's not surprising that the Boeing product looks a lot like the Lockheed product. It's just Lockheed got ahead of it. And our friend of the show, Stephen Trimble, was at a conference, and one of the Lockheed managers had implied that their SR-71-5 prototype had even flown or been shown. So Boeing is taking a two-step process. How do you test something hypersonic? Well, you build something a quarter-scale model of the original of the prototype. So they're going to come out with one the size of an F-16 with one engine, and then build the multiple engine one later on after testing with the scale model. And folks, this is a optionally manned or drone aircraft. No one wants to really be flying around at Mach 5. So it's designed to deliver a payload from the continental United States to a high-value target on the other side of the world in 2 hours or less. So you can read into that North Korea, Iran, etc. And if it's an unmanned aircraft, there's less potential of losing aircrew in those hostile environments.
So this would be when Amazon's not fast enough, you'd use this to deliver a package instead?
Absolutely.
Mach 5. Of course, when you're talking Mach 5, you're talking an engine strategy that includes ramjet or scramjet, something of that sort. And of course, we've talked about that in the past, but one of the features of the ramjet and the scramjet is the actual speed of the vehicle, the airflow speed into the engine inlet handles the function of compressing the air. So you don't need a compressor. And if you don't have a compressor, you don't need a turbine. And now you've just eliminated almost all the moving parts. The trick, though, is to get the thing accelerated up to that speed. How do you do that? And in the case of this Boeing concept, anyway, the strategy is a combined cycle engine. So it really does both functions. It's a turbojet that accelerates up to maybe Mach 3, and then it actually transitions to a ramjet-scramjet configuration to go up to and maybe over Mach 5. So that's something different. I don't think there's anything like that exists, at least not in production.
No, well, the wave rider that we never really seemed to get, which was the small scale, seemed to always disintegrate at speed, was this kind of concept. So I don't know. The only saving grace is one of the things about the SR-71 was it sort of did that. The intakes in those engines eventually did become sort of a ramjet engine slightly.
Right.
But we've gone that fast with the X-15, but the X-15 was a rocket, not a jet engine, so we've flown that fast with people in it. It's just, it's a matter of getting it off the ground and not, and it may be a solution where we're launching them from something like a B-52 or a larger aircraft to get it up to speed.
How big is this thing?
About the size of an SR-71.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, okay, so...
Yeah, so that's pretty big.
Yeah, I mean, the SR-71 was a reconnaissance airplane, and David, you were kind of referring to this as if it's going to be some sort of a warhead delivery device, which, I mean, maybe it is, but that doesn't sound like a son of Blackbird to me. But
well, yeah, it did. The SR-71 originally was RS-71, Reconnaissance Strike, and then Lyndon B. Johnson proceeded to flip it accidentally, and it became Strategic Reconnaissance. But the YF-12A had bays and was going, which was the fighter version or the interceptor version of the SR-71, and they were always intended to have the ability to deliver a strike payload. In this case, it's delivering a strike payload or reconnaissance. Thus far, we're back to strategic reconnaissance or strike reconnaissance. So it's a multi-mission platform, but it's the ability to get projection at a very high rate of speed from the continental United States. It's using kind of the same logic as the B-2. You don't have to worry about bases that are forward operating if you're launching them from the middle of Kansas.
No, that's pretty cool, and you could be home in time for dinner.
Tuck the kids in.
Yeah, David, one of the things that I couldn't tell by the photo of this, it looks like the engines are in line with the fuselage as opposed to the way the SR-71 has the engines out on the wings. Is that really a requirement for the aerodynamics? Or
if you believe the XB-70 program, yes. The reason why the Valkyrie looked the way it did was it flew on a shockwave. Part of the lift was the shockwaves entering into the intakes of the engines. That's why the wings on the XB-70 folded down so that it could surf the waves that it was generating to increase its speed. If you look at both the Lockheed product and the Boeing product, they are using a lifting body shape and they're having the engines underneath so that intake will increase the lift of the fuselage.
Do you think there's really been a hole in this capability between the SR-71 and whenever this comes to be? You think there's something flying around right now, David, fulfilling that role?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that something is lurking out in Area 51 or Area 52, if you want to call the Duggert Proving Grounds, Area 52. The SR-71 was an extremely costly platform. I mean, it was expensive to operate. And I know that we did have a gap, and Desert Storm was one of those ones where it was proven that satellites were not the optimal thing because you sometimes could not project quickly a satellite where you needed it to be. The U-2 is still in existence as a reconnaissance platform, but that's more signals intelligence. There is a gap, but I have a feeling that the reason why these are coming out so quickly is they're coming out from the dark or the black projects. Hmm. But that's just my speculation. But I'm pretty well versed in black projects.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, this is one of those things that, I mean, everybody loves to follow these because they're just, you know, big and fast and just fast. So we have this story from Telesur, which is a Latin American public service platform. Costa Rica suspends airline amid probe into fatal crash. And this is about the Nature Air crash. That carrier's been suspended by Costa Rica's Civil Aviation Agency. The Nature Air Caravan, that was the one that crashed recently, killed both Costa Rican pilots and 10 U.S. citizens, including a family of five from New York. Rob, one of the pilots, I think, wasn't he the company's director of training?
Yeah, it doesn't bode too well for the director of training to have been driving the airplane that ended up in the ground. Of course, now what we do know is that the weather was pretty decent, and it's caravan, you know, what happened after that, we don't know. It's going to be an interesting one, because I don't know that it carried a cockpit voice recorder or a flight data recorder on it.
Yeah, that could make it tough.
Oh, it's going to make it nigh on to impossible if it doesn't have that.
Hmm. Well, apparently Nature Air is shedding the management team. Its operations manager just quit, according to these reports, and its aerial security director has requested a leave of absence. So it appears that the civil aviation authorities move to shut them down may be coming as much from the lack of a management team as it is for the actual crash.
Well, yeah, it looks a little strange.
And the caravan has such a remarkable reputation that you almost have to immediately leap to pilot error. When I got trained on the caravan back at the flight safety, the product manager for that product was visiting from Cessna, and he told us that that thing goes more than a million hours between engine shutdowns, and that in those cases, almost all of them are pilot error or, you know, maintenance errors as well, too. So that thing is about as reliable as an airplane as you can get out there. Now, didn't they have another crash years earlier?
Yes, I think they did, actually, although I don't remember the details right now.
Yep, I found it here. Back in 2005, a de Havilland was destroyed upon impact with trees and terrain. They say it was a loss of control while on final approach to the airport, which, again, is pretty unusual. You know, when you're on final, how do you get a loss of control unless you were distracted or weren't really paying attention or, you know, somehow weren't doing what you should have been doing?
And Max T, aren't there an awful lot of these aircraft in service? Because I believe FedEx is flying a fair amount of them to get from regional airport to regional airport. So beyond the tourism component, they're really a workhorse of an aircraft, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I think at one time FedEx owned something like half of the ones out there in the fleet. I think it's probably down to a third or something like this. But yes, there's a very large number of these airplanes out there, so there's a tremendous amount of reliability data on them.
There's a line in this article that's kind of interesting. It says, earlier this week, Costa Rican authorities raided Nature Air's offices in what they described as a routine operation to collect information.
Yeah, right.
A raid is a routine operation. I don't know. That doesn't sound very good.
Yeah, for a country that doesn't have a military, you kind of think using the word raid isn't something that they normally do.
Hmm. Maybe that's a translation issue or something. Yeah. Well, going from the small caravan to the large 380, ATW Online has a quite interesting article about the A380. It says, Leahy confirms A380 future hinges on Emirates order. And this comes from a webinar, an Airbus 2017 orders and deliveries webinar. John Leahy, the Airbus COO, said, if we can't work out a deal with Emirates, it is clear we will have to shut down the program. We've been talking about the future of the Airbus A380 on and off for quite a while, it seems. I think it is true. I mean, Emirates is kind of the key, since about half of all the A380s sold have gone to Emirates. But I don't know. This could be the end approaching.
Well, hasn't Emirates had some you know, a bit of a downturn in their business here over the last year or so? Some of it associated with new restrictions here flying into the U.S.?
Absolutely. And they've had, I mean, that's what, you know, the Airbus people were kind of hoping they might figure a way around, was that, economic issue, because the price of oil is down. It's been down for a couple of years, and, the Middle East is feeling the pain of not having as much money in their checkbook as they used to. And again, they're, you know, Airbus was hoping that if they re-engined the A380 at one time, maybe that might work. But they're not even looking at that anymore. They're just trying to get people to buy some more of them right now, And I guess Emirates is about the only one that really seems to want them, and not even that much.
Yeah, and Max, go on, David.
I was going to say, am I the only one that's really impressed with that this podcast will outlive that aircraft?
Wow. Well,
and I still haven't flown on it. It's still on my bucket list of aircraft to fly on.
So I know we've talked about this a number of different times. Have we ever taken a stand and kind of put a stake in the ground and said, yep, the A380 is most likely going to come to end of life here pretty soon?
It's dead.
You're pretty close.
Yeah.
I think so,
Thank God. It's an ugly airplane. No, it needs to go away.
Yeah, I was just looking at deliveries. You said almost half, and at least according to Wikipedia, there have been 217 delivered, 101 have gone to Emirates, and the next highest is Singapore with 19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's just a huge difference between the carriers that have them. And then quickly looking, looks like Qantas, Lufthansa, Air France, and BA are the next ones.
Which really clearly illustrates why a company doesn't want to have half their business with one customer, because you live and die on that customer, and I think that's what they're seeing right now.
You know, these things are often a timing issue. Just think about the lead time to go from initial concept to development and design and production. I mean, look at all the years that transpire. So with such long lead times, you have to predict what the market needs pretty far into the future. And that's not always easy. And companies have stumbled in the past on that. When Pratt & Whitney was, ruling the skies with the JT8D engines and 727s and the very early 737s, looking at the future of the 737, Pratt & Whitney made a decision thinking that, well, it really wasn't going to be worth it to develop a new engine for that. Well, CFM International came in with a different view of that, and now they own the 737. But similarly with the A380, you place your bets as to what the market is going to need. It doesn't have anything to do with whether it's a good airplane or not. Do the economics work out for the operators? And you have to bet what the environment's going to be 20 years down the road. So this is a really tough thing to do. But that's also why, for example, on the A380, why Pratt & Whitney and GE collaborated on the engine for that. Rolls-Royce, of course, went on their own. But Pratt and GE got together because it shares the risk. And right now it sounds like that was probably a good decision. But, you place your bets, you bet the company in this industry, and you wait and see what happens.
And why didn't they ever make a freighter version?
No demand. I mean, one was spec'd out.
Yeah, I think Airbus was hoping for A380 freighters, but
you might find that once these become on the surplus market, you may find some freight companies saying, "Okay, at that price, it is worth it."
Yeah. Well, yeah, Singapore's got rid of some of their original, I believe, four of their original aircraft, so. Yeah, they're coming up on the secondary market.
And Delta's going to buy them for local convenience because they're so cheap.
Oh, dear.
Nope. They're going to China for flight training.
Rob, do we understand that you've got to earn the rent and punch out here?
Do we understand?
Yeah,
I understand. I don't know. How do you define we?
That's the royal we.
The royal we.
Yeah, all of us.
Yes. I'm afraid I. Well, it. Yeah, I kind of do actually. I mean, I've got two stories on the other machine that need. Attended to, and it's the get the stories in ASAP week for the next issue. So hopefully, maybe we'll have a guest next week. I didn't look ahead.
Oh, yes, we do.
We do.
All right. So we'll expect to see you then next week, Rob.
Yeah. Thank you much. You know what we ought to have? We ought to have a sound effect for an ejection seat.
yeah, punching out, huh?
Yeah, so and it's gone. All right, that's just my thought. So, all right, guys, have a good one. What's left of it, sure. And I also just want you to know I did my part tonight. I spent an hour out there with the snowblower, digging through all the snow we got the last couple of days. It was really fun, but okay, I'm ready for spring in Chicago.
Yes. All right.
All right, you guys be good. We'll talk to you next week.
See you, Rob.
Have a good one.
All right, take care, man. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Rob.
All right,
hey,
Dave.
Max.
Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, can I do my segment and then punch out too?
Okay.
Because my fever's kicking in.
All right. Yeah, we're shedding co-hosts right and left.
The other two can handle it.
And now here's David Vanderhoof with the airplane of the week.
Thanks, Max. We're going to continue with where we left off last week, which is the EC-121. So after college, I came the Rivet Top missions. Again, flown out of Udorn Royal Thai Air Force Base, the EC-121 was upgraded to the M. The upgrade included two new systems and highly trained operators who understood the Soviet SRO and SOD-57 transponders used by the MiGs. This eventually became Rivet Jim, which supplemented the crews with Vietnamese-speaking intelligence officers. They could monitor communications between the ground control intercept officers and the North Vietnamese MiGs. Because of being able to listen in and understand the Vietnamese commands, Rivet Jim was highly classified. The system, though, had a flaw. Listeners did not have scopes, so they could hear the conversation. However, they needed to feed the information to the controllers, which caused a delay and made it difficult to warn the Allied aircraft under attack. The other issue with Rivet Jim was it was a signals intelligence asset. It reported to the NSA, the National Security Agency. They could not report to the aircraft directly until 1972. The information had to be approved by the NSA official before it could be relayed in real time. So what you end up having is you have fighters under attack, we're aware of the attack, but we have to have some bureaucrat sign off saying, yes, it's an attack before we can notify the aircraft they're under attack. Typical bureaucracy. Eventually, Rivet Jim upgrades were added to all College Eye aircraft. The U.S. military wanted to free the U.S. POWs at the Son Tay prison. This mission would eventually be named Operation Kingpin for the EC-121s. Two EC-120Ds were modified with brand new electronic suites based on the Navy E-1B tracer. The stoof with a roof was being used by Task Force 77 in the Gulf of Tonkin. The two EC-121Ts, as they were now known, were deployed, sent with a C-121G to Karat Royal Thai Air Force Base to deploy personnel. The equipment was forward deployed by classified airlift. The two aircraft were ready for missions on November 17, 1970. This is a testament to the ground crews who set up the systems without testing. There were only handwritten notes and no manuals to support the crews. Also, the equipment was not allowed to be tested in the continental United States due to regulations about frequency emissions. So Frago 1 and Frago 2 took off 10 minutes apart and headed to their stations on the coast of Vietnam in the Gulf of Tonkin. Both aircraft had 17-man crews to guide the United States Air Force F-4 MIGCAPs. Frago 1 climbed to altitude, then ruptured a fuel line. Frago 1 lost the engine and had to return to Da Nang and make a safe three-engine landing. The EC-121s were commonly known as the world's greatest tri-motor. They were constantly coming back to base, missing an engine. Frog 2 became the primary aircraft and immediately had all sorts of issues with the new electronics. The IFF, or Identity Friend or Foe system, rapidly became overloaded and would not display properly on the scopes. Another unintended consequence of the mission was a nearby EKA-3B Sky Warrior jamming aircraft, which inadvertently jammed the EC-121T. Eventually, Frog-02 only could provide supplemental vectoring for the CAP Phantoms. Operation Kingpin was a failure. The rescue of the 61 POWs didn't occur because they had been moved by the North Vietnamese force. With Operation Linebacker, the upgraded EC-121Ts were moved to fly orbits in Laotian's airspace. This mission was known as Disco. The EC-121Ts were an improvement, and the tracking MiGs were made easier. Eventually, a color system of bandits became the standard notification system. Red were MiG-17s, white were MiG-19s, blue were MiG-21s, and blacks were MiGs low on fuel. By the end of Disco in 1974, the EC-121s had flown over 13,900 missions with 98,000 accident-free hours. The successes were 25 MiGs down by direction, and more importantly, 80 aircrew recovered because of the Warning Star. Lastly, 40 Willie Victor 2s and 3s were flown out of the boneyard to become EC-121s. 25 of these were part of the Igloo White program. This involved the deployment of ground sensors on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Operation Batcat used EC-121Rs. They lost both the radomes and were camouflaged in Southeast Asian camouflage. 30219 brown, 34102 medium green, and 34079 dark green over 36622 gray. Two Batcats were lost. The Batcat mission was flown 18 hours in length and various tracks over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Batcats were supported by QU-22 Pave Eagles based on the Beechcraft Bonanza. These were to be unmanned drones. See what I did there? However, they were always flown manned. They would drop sensors onto the trail. The sensors would seismically detect movement and send data up to the Batcat 121Rs. With that, the Connie is a beautiful aircraft. The Willie Victor or the Warning Star are the heroes of the Constellation family. And with that, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
All right. Thanks, David.
All right, gentlemen. Good night. Have a good rest of the show.
Okay. Thanks again.
Good night, David. Hope you get better soon.
Well, now we have an Across the Pond submission from Peter Johnson.
What's that?
I know. Well, I understand. I understand, Brian, you had a hand in encouraging Peter to come back with another Across the Pond episode.
Encourage, pester, yeah, whatever.
All right.
Yes,
well,
I did.
Peter's back. He's got an update on his 2017. He talks about the Falklands Air War, his journey to get the book on the Faraday Barracuda promoted, and how it all started back here on the Airplane Geeks 7 years ago. So here's Peter.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and here we are back across the pond. With Stephen Grant's recent announcement, I felt I really should make a contribution back home. Yeah, I know, Brian, you've been chasing me for this segment for months. Dare I say, a year or two. Well, weeks late, this quick summary should have come to you as part of the Bits and Pieces episode, but I can't even get an extended episode out on time, so there's no hope here. So, I just thought it'd be good to have a quick catch-up on what's happened in my aviation world in the past year. Well, extended swamped all of my spare time, particularly our four-part feature on the 35th anniversary of the Falklands War. We focused on the air war covering preparations, Sea Harrier operations, the Royal Navy's use of helicopters, and finally, the Argentine angle, something I'm not sure has ever been done on this medium before. A lot of the content proved new, and some was even contentious and controversial. Having the outspoken Commander Sharky Ward proved a massive hit, with that episode being so popular our server almost broke when we were seeing downloads every 20 seconds at one point.
Argentina's military is, as you say, completely run down. The colleagues I have, the people I know in South America, there's still a very strong, strong feeling that the Malvinas belong to Argentina. And it would not be out of the question for them in the future to say, all right, well, enough is enough. We're going to take it and keep it this time.
All aside, I'm very proud of that series. And if you've not heard any of them yet, do give it a try. But it was my links back to the Airplane Geeks and my old Across the Pond segment that proved to make the year really memorable. It was last year that the book written by Matt Willis on my dad's aircraft, the Faraday Barracuda, really hit the shelves. For those with good memories, we talked to Matt on this show some 7 or so years ago now when he started writing the book, and we published some of my father's thoughts and recordings about his wartime exploits on the show here. Well, in the summer of 2017, I went to the Royal Navy's Premier Air Station at Yeovilton, where I'd been so many times with my dad, and in the hangar where the Fleet Air Arm Museum is assembling the last only known Barracuda airframe, we recorded the segment, which I'd planned 7 years ago on the aircraft, the book, and my father. My dad and Derek Armson and people like that were very familiar with.
Yeah, certainly Derek would have been, and he talked to me a lot about the torpedo training that they did. This is a bulk, this is the large part of a torpedo director type F. So this box here is the computer type F. As you say, it's a grey box. It has a couple of windows in it with dials. What this bit of kit was for, it was an analog computer that enabled the pilot or the observer to direct the torpedoes to attack enemy shipping.
With Max, that's Max East, of course, with Max's permission, we reused some of the Airplane Geeks content I recorded back then, and with the airshow playing in the background, talked about the Royal Navy's most heavily produced aircraft of all time. I'd produced the episode partly for my own satisfaction, and never for one moment expected the success it gained. Again, like our Falklands episodes, the Fairy Barracuda episode proved to be one of our most popular ever. One social media post getting over 130 likes, which for us is absolutely unheard of. So, back to my year, 2017. In so many ways, the success is down to the Airplane Geeks and, of course, Max, without whom, 7 years later, I would not have a book about an aircraft my father flew in, featuring some of his stories, signed by the author, who I can now call a very close friend. On top of that, we did the interview next to pieces of the aircraft Dad knew so well. So come on over to Extended and listen in sometime. Remember, we're part of the Airplane Geeks family. I'll too try a little harder and bring you some content back from over here, across the pond, of course, a little more often. Yes, Brian, I heard you. So, don't be a stranger. If you want to find me, apart from over on Extended, on Twitter, Facebook, and of course the webpage, you can also find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter. Or if you're into Facebook, I'm lurking around on the Airplane Geeks Facebook page, which I help to monitor and run. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Boy, it's so good to hear from Peter again. For those of you who are, well, relatively new listeners, Peter provided a segment just about every episode called Across the Pond, and we miss those. Peter, of course, is also at aviation-extended.co.uk, no leading E on extended. And we'll have links in the show notes to the Falklands War series that Peter did, as well as that episode on the Fairy Barracuda. So again, thanks, Peter. Peter has also been pretty active in managing our Facebook page, which had kind of gone, well, maybe lacking the focus that that we'd had in the past. So we really want to thank Peter for that. And if Facebook is you know, the thing that you like to do, be sure to find the Airplane Geeks Facebook page.
Yeah, and I just want to add that Peter did a fantastic job on the on his series on the Falklands. So if anyone's interested, definitely go over and check out his work. It's really quite well done.
All right. Well, Max Trescott, you've spent some time at a Cirrus sales and training conference. Is that the way to describe it? Tell us a little bit about what you were up to.
Sure. So last year, a year ago, was the first time that Cirrus held a conference they called CX, which I think stands for Customer Experience. I didn't attend this one, but I went to the one this year, which was held in San Diego for 3 days. And basically, it's a gathering of the Cirrus sales force from the U.S., as well as both their training partners, folks like me who teach in Cirrus aircraft, and their service partners as well, too. So we got to all hang out for 3 days, listen to a lot of different presentations from a lot of really interesting people. And one of them was Pete Bunce. Now, Pete is the president of the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, GAMA. And I know quite some time ago we had Pete on the show here as a guest, and he was talking about a number of different things. I recorded his presentation, and I thought I would share a couple of the items here. He's talking about the Export Bank and also some infrastructure initiatives. And then I've got some other recordings from Pete that I'll share this week on the Aviation News Talk podcast. But let's go ahead and run what Pete has to say.
EXIM Bank, very important for us as manufacturers to be able to sell product all over globally. Whether you're a U.S. manufacturer or whether you're a European manufacturer, where you build aircraft, have a capability to support you. It happens, the French government does it, the Brazilian government, the Canadian government. Well, here in the U.S., some conservative members of Congress call it crony capitalism, that we have a bank that actually does help secure loans. But we as manufacturers scratch our heads. You know, it brings in money for the federal government. Every other country in the world does this. Why would we cut ourselves off as Americans to be able to go and not have the Ex-Im Bank functioning? Well, there was a package of five folks that came up for the Ex-Im Bank basically to be on the board. The person that was proposed to run it, Congressman Sullivan, was someone that was very much against the Ex-Im Bank. And he was one of those that labeled it crony capitalism. So our allies in the Senate defeated him as being the chairman of that group. But unfortunately, then that stymied the other four nominees because we need to have a quorum to be able to move the bank forward. So we're still working this issue with members of Congress to try to get the bank back functioning. It is not just a GE and a Boeing issue. This has implications for every single company that goes and produces aircraft. And in fact, Cirrus would be a beneficiary of Ex-Im Bank financing to be able to sell to certain countries under certain conditions, our engine manufacturers as well. White House, crazy place right now, but we do have allies in the White House. And we've got folks that are working right now to be able to go and structure different packages as we move to infrastructure to go and implement some of the ideas that we put forward. Now, you all know we've been in a tussle about air traffic control reform with both the White House and the Congress as of late. But there's a new thing that's working its way through the process, which is the infrastructure program. And there's some very logical things that we can do with infrastructure in the U.S. that goes and takes this modern world of telecommunications and applies it to the infrastructure we have, aging infrastructure that we have out there. Everyone has heard of BRAC that's associated with the military. We've had three rounds of BRAC. We've gone and reduced the footprint of the military base structure in the U.S. to be able to be more cost effective. We can do the same thing in this modern era of telecommunications. Do we really need 20 plus centers out there? And especially some of them that are very, very cost intensive to keep running. The one in Minneapolis, in there floods all the time. Do we need to equip 21 centers with new technology over the long period of time to take advantage of Datacom and some of the other enablers out there? Or can we go with a different program where we right-size the national airspace system? And that's what we're actually trying to talk to folks in the White House about as they structure the infrastructure package.
Pete Bunce is a pretty sharp guy.
Indeed. He talked about a lot of different topics that Gamma is on top of in Washington. Now, the last time he mentioned there, I had not heard of and had even thought of, which is consolidation of the FAA centers. Here in Northern California, we consolidated five different approach controls over the last probably 10 years. So Monterey approach and Bay approach, Stockton approach, Sacramento approach, and Reno approach all got consolidated. So those people came out of the individual towers where they were located and went into a consolidated facility near Sacramento. And that had a lot of benefits to them from a staffing standpoint because they no longer had lots of little tiny groups of people scattered around, and they could more efficiently staff the combined organization.
Yeah,
it had never occurred to me that you could do that with the centers and probably get a lot of savings there as well. And certainly as people talk about moving to next gen, Pete makes a good point. Why go ahead and have to equip, 20-some different buildings when you might have fewer consolidated centers operating air traffic control here in the U.S.?
Now, you mentioned that you're going to have some more of Pete's comments on your, the next aviation news talk?
That's right. Yep. So later this week, that'll come out, and we'll be talking about the EPA, and he's got some comments on FAA privatization and also ADSB. So we'll run those then. And the other thing I wanted to mention is back in December, I decided to just consolidate what I'm doing, and I'm now doing 100% Cirrus training. So I was busier over the holidays than I've ever been after I decided to focus on just the Cirrus. So doing a lot of training for people to help them transition into their new aircraft, and also doing a lot of consulting for folks who are looking to buy one, either a new one or a used one. So I'll just throw that out. Anybody thinking of buying a Cirrus, no matter where you are in the world, go ahead and contact me because I'm doing a lot of that these days.
Great. All right. Now, Brian, we mentioned earlier that you attended CES this year, 2018. CES, of course, is the event that used to be known as the Consumer Electronics Show, and for some reason they decided a little while ago to rename it just simply CES. That was in Las Vegas, and you have several interviews that you recorded for us.
Yeah, I do. It was fun being out there. It was the first time that I was ever actually able to make it to Las Vegas for the show. I knew that it was big. Some other shows that I used to do in Vegas are things like NAMM, Comdex, and CES makes those shows pale in comparison over just how large it is.
Yeah.
So that definitely took me by surprise. It was, I thought, phenomenally well organized. They had many of the vendors sectioned off, so it made it easy to find the vendors that you were interested in. So they had, for example, a drone area. They had a augmented reality, virtual reality center. They had an automotive center. They had, of course, the traditional consumer electronics with radios and televisions and things like that. And then, of course, because of what I've been involved with recently, I wandered over to the 3D printing area and got some interviews over there as well. But one of the, I think, most surprising people or companies that I saw at CES was Bell Helicopter. And I was fortunate enough to talk with Bob Hastings, who's the VP of Communications and Government Affairs, about the Bell Air Taxi. Hi, everyone. I'm here with Bob Hastings of Bell Helicopter. I see on display you have a real interesting product here. Can you tell the listeners about it?
Yeah, so what we brought to the Consumer Electronics Show this year is the cockpit, the cabin of a future air taxi. So you don't see the wings and the powertrain, but we brought everything that has to do with the consumer experience here to share it with people at CES.
And the airframe that's going to be built into, which one is it?
So we're obviously keeping that behind the cloak of secrecy.
Okay.
We're not the only people that believe in air taxi. First of all, we believe very much that air taxi will be a viable means of transportation in the future, but we're not the only ones. And so for competitive purposes, we're keeping the secret stuff secret.
Fair enough. As far as informing customers of the experience, when do you think that I'd be able to get into an air taxi, and what's the typical range that you guys are envisioning for this?
So we're working very hard right now on developing an air taxi and getting it into that life cycle that eventually leads to certification. We think probably in the mid-2020s. It's about as safe as we can predict right now because there's always variables.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to design it, manufacture it, fly it, test it, and then get it certified by the regulatory authorities in the United States, the FAA.
And they are conservative.
Well, so we're tagging 2020. You're right. They are conservative, and they should be, right?
Yep.
You, I, and every other consumer out here want to have the confidence that when we get into an aircraft, it's safe. We actually believe, though, that that's one of the reasons that Bell has joined the air taxi. There's a gazillion people out there building them right now. The vast majority of them are in garages and small startups that do not have aviation experience. We believe the consumers should get an air taxi built by an aircraft manufacturer. It's one of the reasons we've joined this.
Yeah, well, you certainly have the name in helicopters that people can trust.
Right. So. Well, we've been making things move across the Earth's surface for more than 80 years.
Right.
So we're pretty confident we can be successful with this.
What do you guys envision to be the typical range of a flight with someone taking an air taxi?
Yeah, so it is. So I think the answer there is in the title, air taxi. We think it's within a city. It's within an urban span. It's going to be, so if you take Dallas, for example, Dallas has signed up to be one of the testbed cities for air taxi.
Okay.
It's between the suburbs and the DFW airport, between the suburbs and downtown. So if you wanted to go to Austin, you'd go to Southwest or American Airlines and go down there. That we can't do that more efficiently. But if you have a choice between calling an Uber, who is our partner on this, and riding for an hour and 10 minutes to get to the airport, or calling an air taxi and getting there in 7 minutes, we think most people will choose the 7-minute choice.
So do you think places like shopping centers or malls will start to open up their space for air taxi, or am I still going to have to go to a regional airport in order to get in a taxi?
So I think the answer is somewhere in between. So you're probably not going to have to go to an airport. In fact, we think the FAA will probably move us away from airports, except for a connector into an airport like DFW. They're going to want to put vertiports or heliports around the city in places that keep you away from the traffic, the air traffic. But certainly put you where the ground traffic would have taken you anyway. So we're only going to make this work if we give consumers an alternative to getting in a car and getting in traffic.
Right. There are certainly some cities in the U.S. where helicopters are really popular or prevalent. I'm thinking New York City certainly being one. I could imagine Houston, Dallas, as you said. Internationally, I know places like Sao Paulo have a huge helicopter business. Are there any other cities where you see this as being the first or what could be a launch city for the service?
So Dubai has officially raised the flag. They want to be the first city to have an air taxi service internationally. So they've set a target, one that I'm not sure everyone agrees is doable, but they've set a target of trying to have an air taxi service by Dubai 2020. What that air taxi is will not certainly be the certified ready to fly and take passengers as approved by the FAA product. Mm-hmm. It may be a test aircraft that's there at the time. But that's at least Dubai's vision of how fast they'd like to move.
Do you think because certifying agencies are different internationally that you might be able to get certification sooner in a country like Dubai than the U.S.?
So just personal opinion, I don't think so.
Okay.
So there's a lot of certifying agencies in the world, but they all tend to line up around kind of the big five, right? So the FAA, Transport Canada, EASA, CAC in China, Brazil. Has a leading certification agency, and then you'll find most of the rest of the world line up around one of those.
Okay.
And there's numerous bilateral agreements among them all that keep them all kind of parallel. And that is, it's done deliberately, and it's done for a purpose so that when you get on an American aircraft in Dubai, you have standards that you expected as an American, but that Dubai aircraft that's taken off out of Chicago is also certified to similar standards.
Right.
So the regulatory agencies are largely aligned around the world.
Okay. The first version, you had said before that you're building this autonomously, but there will be a pilot on board for the first round.
Yeah. So, you know, part of the reason we came to CES is in the past, the decision makers around helicopters were largely the operators, right? It's either the pilot, the mechanic, the CFO, if it's a fleet operator. They're looking for, and they have different reasons to have confidence in that product. Once we move to air taxi, it's going to be you making an emotional decision. Do you want to put your family in that aircraft and send them across town? So we came to CES to start showing this to the average consumer so they begin to get confident with the idea. The pilot in the front seat is the next step in that. So we're going to build it autonomous. We believe it should be autonomous. But we also believe that in the very beginning, you're going to want to look up front and see somebody with wings pinned on their chest. What's interesting, though, is to most of the world, they're going to use the term pilot. We're actually calling that person a mission manager because it will be an autonomous aircraft, and it will be flying autonomously, even though there's someone sitting in the pilot seat.
So they're really an observer and just ensuring that nothing happens.
They're ensuring the safety of that aircraft, but it's much more for the confidence of the public getting in it, not for the safe operation of the aircraft. In fact, there's tons of evidence that would lead you to believe that the aircraft would operate safer without interference of humans than with interference, right?
Right. Yep. How can people find out more information about Bell Air Taxi?
So I'd say right now, just watch our website. You know, we'll keep it posted as we make developments. We obviously communicate this often to the news media. For those of us that are aviation geeks, you'll see stories about this in the appropriate publications that cover that.
Okay, and that's bellhelicopters.com, correct?
Bellhelicopter.com.
Okay, it's only one.
Right, there's only one Bell Helicopter company, so it's bellhelicopter.com.
Perfect. Bob, thank you so much for your time. Really
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you very much.
Oh, nice interview. Brian, well done.
Thanks.
It's too bad. David had to drop off. It's too bad, but in the last episode of the UAV Digest, we talked about the Volocopter, which is also building, designing an air taxi to be autonomous. And they actually had a demonstration at CES. They had a flight in an auditorium just above a stage, and it was tethered, just for safety purposes, but the thing did rise up above the stage a little bit. And they're very active in this Dubai desire that Bob mentioned, this desire to implement air taxi service in Dubai, really within a couple of years' time. So things are moving very quickly.
Yeah, how many passengers was that other vehicle capable of carrying?
I would say two is my understanding. I think it's two.
Okay.
And it, you know, I don't know. Well, we have a photo that that you brought with Brian. We'll put in the show notes showing that Bell air taxi cabin, if you will. If you look at the UAVDigest.com, this is our latest episode, is 226. You see an image of the Volocopter, which takes I'm not sure it's the same approach that Bell is going to take. In this case, it's more like a giant multi-rotor in that it has, I think it's 16 rotors arranged in a circular configuration. Curious to see what Bell does with that cabin that they've shown at CES. So very cool.
Yeah, I tried to get him to spill the beans on the airplane, but he just wouldn't budge.
All right. What's next, Brian?
So I was over at the Flash Forge booth and spoke with Dana of Flash Forge and Bill Steele of one of their partners, Polar 3D. And Polar 3D is really taking an interesting look at training and education of the 3D space and just how to get engineers educated. And I think they have a great partner in FlashForge with their product line. One bit of warning about this recording, Dana is from mainland China, and some people might find it, especially with the recording quality that I got, a little bit difficult to understand her because of the accent and probably mostly my recording quality. So I apologize in advance for that. But we could hear them talk about their unique solution.
Hi, this is Brian, and I'm back here at CES at the Flash Forge booth talking with Dana and Bill from Polar 3D. Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. Come here.
Thanks for having us.
So, Dana, you have a whole bunch of different product lines in the 3D printing space. Can you talk a little bit about the different markets that you're serving with the printers?
Yeah, actually, we provide three Land Rover 3D printers, one for education, and we have Fender Inventor 2 and the new released Adventure 3. It's for education system. We have very feedback from some of schools, especially the Fender 3D printers, and now focus on more professional 3D printers like Guide 2 and Hunter. And in future, we will develop more professional 3D printers.
Bill, you're doing some interesting stuff with cloud software. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that ties in?
In our case, we focus on the education space. A biggest part of their line is the education printers that they have. So what we've done is we've taken their printers and we've modified them to work with the Polar Cloud through both software and hardware modifications. We've added cameras. The software is actually we call Polar Cloud Enabled. The Polar Cloud is a platform for schools, classrooms, that allows many students to use any number of printers. And we provide curriculum and training and everything that a school needs to teach about additive manufacturing.
And one of the use cases for this in aerospace could be, let's say, if you had a bunch of engineers sitting around, they need to get educated on the 3D space, so you can
exactly.
Read and evaluate them as well, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So, interestingly enough, GE came to us a while back and said, hey, we have a problem. We don't have enough engineers that know additive manufacturing, and we need to train them. We need to figure out how to do this. So we developed a platform, a program for them for the education market that allows us to take the FlashForge Inventor printers and put them into the classroom and teach students in schools how to use additive manufacturing. The big thing that's different that GE understands now is that when you think about design for additive, when you're building a part, you have to think about it totally different. You're not taking part away from a block of metal, right, like Michelangelo did. You're creating from nothing. And that gives you a lot more freedom in the designs that you come up with. You can make lighter parts, more efficient parts, you know, build them faster and stronger.
Parts within parts.
Parts within parts that no one has ever touched and no one will ever touch in their life, right?
Right.
Exactly. So very complex parts. So GE has, as a good example, they have this one engine. They took over 860 parts and reduced them to 12 just by changing mindsets. But a lot of engineers are stuck in the old ways and they don't understand. They need to be exposed to this new design thinking, right?
So you're helping them with, on the education standpoint, get their engineers up to speed on how to use the 3D
yep.
design software and then actually...
Yep. How to envision the product. I mean, just from the basics of it, right? It's you start with a totally different blank slate when you're doing that. GE's engineers and their current engineers need to be trained on it. But the biggest problem that GE has is their future engineers.
Right.
They need to have kids coming out of school know how to, you know, jump right into an additive manufacturing world, design parts efficiently. So that's really where our biggest focus is.
Dana, what's the age group that you've seen in the education space? I mean, how young are the children starting with 3D printing?
Actually, as far as I know, the kids are five years old. Yeah, they can design the works in their mind, and so they can make their ideas come true. And I think it's very helpful for them to develop the creativity. Or
I think it's funny. As a side note, my granddaughter, when she was 2 years old, we kind of introduced her to 3D printing. And so she asked me to draw her a Mickey Mouse. And she saw that it was laying down filament. It looked like it was drawing to her, right? She will never know the world without a 3D printer, without being able to additive manufacture.
So these are now the engineers of tomorrow.
That's
starting
right.
at 5 years old.
Yep. So we have a curriculum on our platform called Steam Tracks. And in Steam Tracks, it starts at kindergarten. And we have them designing. We teach them about life sciences, not 3D printing or additive manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
We teach them about what they're using it for. So in this case, life sciences like butterfly metamorphosis. So it starts out as a caterpillar. So they use a tool called Tinkercad to design a caterpillar. And then later on, they learn about the phases of metamorphosis. And then they design their wings. And the wings snap onto the caterpillar to make the butterfly.
And just like building an airplane.
Exactly. And these are kids doing that.
So how can people find out more about your printers?
Flashforward.com.
Okay. Yeah. And Bill, how can people find out about you guys?
So we're at polar3d.com.
Great. Thank you so much for your time and being on the show.
No
Appreciate
problem.
It.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
There's some really insightful notions in there that I hadn't really thought about before this, Brian. One is, and I think, Mac T, you can... empathize with this, but when you look at designing parts for an engine, for an aircraft, whatever, you know, as they mentioned, the historic perspective is you start with something and you cut and grind and turn and, you know, you machine generally components, form them out of something larger. And that's going to create a certain engineering mindset. But when you look at additive manufacturing, it inverts the whole thing, right? It's not a perspective of removing material. It's a perspective of creating material. And that's a different thinking process, I would assume.
Yeah, no question. I think we're seeing so many different technologies that are revolutionizing aviation these days. Additive manufacturing is just one of them. It's stunning to me that you could take for example, 100 parts and boil them down to just one. You think about that in terms of the kind of reliability you get now. You've got that many fewer parts to fail, potential cost improvements. I mean, it's just remarkable times that we live in.
And weight reduction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all these things.
Yeah.
It probably even cost, you know, think about the cost to build one part as opposed to, you know, build 100 parts individually.
Right.
Yeah, and there's the other bit over vendor management as well, because oftentimes when you have 300 parts, they're coming from other manufacturers. So now there's that reduction as well. So from a logistics standpoint, contract standpoint, really throughout the entire supply chain, there's efficiencies that are built into the process as well.
And it's one of the reasons why I think I'm so interested and fascinated with the additive manufacturing. I need to stop calling it 3D printing, but because it really is additive manufacturing. Yep. And I find it really fascinating. One of the other things that Bill was doing that I thought was really special is because it's a cloud-based platform, so you do your design, it goes up to their cloud system, it analyzes it, then you print it, and they have the software that is embedded in the printer, so they get feedback. They now know how good the engineer is designing their product or how many times their system has failed in the print process. So I think it's another way of ranking students. And it's one thing to graduate college and say, oh, yeah, I did this. It's another thing, I think, to come out and say, yeah, well, I had a 95% success rate with the design. Or you could look at the efficiency of the designs that I had, for example.
Yeah.
So they're adding that extra twist to the education side. And I was really impressed over that.
Now, you talked to a couple other companies at CES.
Yeah, I did. And Markforge, there's so many companies that are similar. So Markforge is a company that is working with different metals. And they're actually, if I get this right, they're embedding the metal in a clay-type substance. And after they print the part, they put the part in an oven, basically bake away the clay part, and you're left with just a metal item. And one of the really cool things that they're doing is the strength to weight ratio of the hollow or honeycombed objects that they're able to build that simply aren't possible with the traditional subtractive manufacturing.
Hmm.
Right? Because this is additive. So I talked with John Riley, who is the VP of product, and let's listen to what he has to say.
I am now at the Markforge booth and talking with John Riley, the VP of product. These guys have something really interesting in the 3D space. John, we were talking a little bit before about how you're doing hollow product, but still having the same strength and resiliency of a solid product. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. One of the really interesting things about additive manufacturing, or maybe more commonly known as 3D printing, is it gives you a lot of design flexibility when you're constructing a part. And what we do at Markforged is two things. We print composites and metal. But because we print them, we can create parts with incredibly off-the-chart strength-to-weight ratios. In the composite side, take a plastic and reinforce it with carbon fiber. It's very similar to a lot of the materials you fly today in aerospace. Mm-hmm. And those strength-to-weight ratios become very valuable because, of course, you don't want to pay for the fuel. But in the metal side, we just started a new metal printing process. We call it atomic diffusion additive manufacturing.
That's a mouthful.
Which is a mouthful. But basically what it is, it's based on this existing known technology called metal injection molding. You take a metal powder, bind it in plastic, and you print the plastic into the shape of your part. But for the first time, and of course when you print that part, you can print what we call captive infill or hollow spaces inside the part. And then you put it in a sintering furnace, and it sinters, it shrinks by about 20%, and densifies into the solid metal part. But now you have hollow space inside that part. There's no other manufacturing mechanism that can create a part with hollow internal geometries. And so one of the new rages in designing parts is using this thing called generative design. It's where you use a artificial intelligence or computer program to give it some constraints around where you need strength and the design envelope that the part can fit in, and then it builds the part automatically for you. And there was recently an article published in Nature, which is interesting, where they fed a generative design program an extra degree of flexibility, which is hollow internal structures, and then had it generate an aircraft wing. And it actually made it with hollow internal components, like a bird bone. Because it turns out nature is actually a really good design engine. Given enough time, it optimizes for like strength to weight. And so now we're able to actually start simulating these geometries and creating them additively for the first time. And of course, like over time, as you qualify these for use in aerospace and aviation, you'll start to see lighter weight, still strong parts that reduce fuel consumption and give you a greater degree of flexibility in your designs.
I think the first place that people look at are engines for doing this sort of work. But there are so many other places in an airplane where you can use
The list is pretty much endless. And, you know, I advocate for starting introducing 3D printing in your non-critical flight components because there's this learning curve that we're all going up in the industry. But actually, it's it is the case that there are already both metal injection molded parts, which are very similar to how we print these metal parts without the hollow internal geometries, in use in aircraft engines from Pratt & Whitney, I believe, as well as this famous GE nozzle that's additively manufactured. So we're at the beginning of the space, but it's starting to accelerate very quickly, and they are being used in flight critical components. We expect that in the next 3 to 5 years, that's just going to continue to grow and their adoption will continue to scale.
So one of your other coworkers was telling me, in addition to the parts themselves, that you guys are working with various manufacturers for making tooling.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So one of the things we do, one of the benefits of our, particularly our composite parts, is that they're as strong as machined aluminum and 40% lighter. So there's obvious applications for aerospace, but it also works very well for fixturing, jigs, jaws, and tools in the manufacturing line. And so that means aerospace manufacturing or any type of manufacturing or automated manufacturing application where you've got a robot arm moving parts around. Those parts are traditionally machined out of aluminum. They're both expensive and they have long lead times. We can print that same part with the same strength for about 1/20th the cost. So that's the big value that we've...
Right, so if a part breaks on the assembly line doesn't have to be down for a week while you wait for the manufacturer to deliver the part.
Absolutely correct, yeah. So not only do you get the part faster and for lower cost, but you can recover your line and avoid a lot of expensive downtime.
Because you're not using a powder, does this also mean that this is really a desktop printer as well because you don't have to worry about the flammability, or is this still a printer for a shop?
So it's a printer for the shop. The sintering furnace is not something you'd want to put in an office, and you want to buy the whole package with the end-to-end solution. But your point about the powder is true. Because we bind it in a plastic material before printing it, you're never handling like the basic metal powder itself. And metal powder itself could be either a flame risk or an explosion risk, but more commonly it's a health hazard. And so by binding it inside of a plastic matrix, basically blending it with plastic before you print it or handle it, it becomes safe. It's rendered safe. And so it's a lot easier to use and to handle. You don't need to wear a space suit. And the printing solution itself is actually $125,000. That includes the printer, the washing station to wash the first binding material out of the parts, and the sintering furnace. Traditionally, a 3D printer for metal runs $500,000 to $1 million before you get into post-processing equipment. So we're seeing a big shift in the industry, making it more accessible and more affordable, while also giving you some extra degrees of flexibility in your part design.
So, John, where can people find out more information about Markforged?
The best place is markforged.com. So check us out on the internet. If you'd like to learn more, drop us a line. There's various ways to sign up for information and demos, and we're always happy to talk.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot. Nice to meet you.
Wow. I used to think additive manufacturing was big. Now I think it's even bigger with the, this binding material and all that. You know, it's interesting when new manufacturing processes, I think, are first developed, they tend to be used to do what you've always done, but do it better. And that's kind of a phase one. Phase two can be, well, okay, now that we have this capability that we never had before, what are the things that we can do now that we never thought of in the past? And that's where you get ideas like this, I think. And I mean, this is like the honeycomb, the invention of honeycomb materials, but in a 3D printing environment or an additive manufacturing environment. So I think this is really big.
So what do you think this is going to do for engines?
I think it's, well, see, part of it is, like I say, is going to be how do you reduce the weight and the manufacturing complexity of, and therefore the cost of, component parts, and then what can you do that we couldn't even think of in the past because we didn't have, a way to realize the concept in physical terms. As a component, so it's really hard to say. But I think that it's temperatures, pressures, it's weight and manufacturing cost that I think are the big impact areas at the beginning, anyway.
Yeah, one of the things that I talked about on the show earlier, maybe 4 or 5 episodes ago, was GE saw something like a 20% increase in performance in the engine by having the additive manufacturing parts in the engine. So not only is there the weight savings, but if you get additional power as well out of the engine, that's all goodness.
Sure.
I keep thinking about the low end for turboprops. You know, there's such a huge price difference. What if you could get a turboprop to be competitive with a piston engine or even, you know, somewhat close? I mean, the replacement market would be huge in a single engine aircraft to be able to drop turbines in. Now, some people will do that with Bonanzas, but it's a, you know, it's $250,000 to drop a turbine in the front of your Bonanza. What if it were half that, or, you know, under $100,000? I think that would really open up the market for lightweight, low-cost, smaller turbine engines.
Yeah, I think aviation is going to be really, really different 20 years from now than it is today. All right, Brian, you have one more for us.
Yeah, there's one more. So talked with the folks over at Shining 3D, and they are in a different space in the additive manufacturing world, and they're really looking at the scanning the digitization of various components as well as the printing. And so they're looking at really it from a holistic standpoint, but the bit over digitizing these parts, that's what really captured my imagination with these guys.
Hi, this is Brian. I'm here at CES with Oscar Meza. Oscar is the Vice President of Global Sales, and we're here talking about 3D scanners. So, Oscar, welcome to the Airplane Geek Show.
Thank you very much, Brian, for giving me the opportunity to share this conversation with you.
So before, we were talking about you guys doing some work in the aviation industry. Can you talk broadly about what you're doing and how you're helping solve some problems?
Yeah, well, our technology, and as you mentioned in the introduction, we are a company that develops, manufactures, and sells 3D scanning solutions. But besides 3D scanners, we also provide 3D printers for industrial applications, or what is being now called additive manufacturing. So in those two fronts is where we've been working and cooperating with the aerospace industry in general.
So this is going beyond just 3D print or 3D scanning and printing of parts, either new parts or replacement parts, but actually doing scans for virtual reality or augmented reality, correct?
That is correct. And actually, that's the philosophy of the company. I mean, I think we are perhaps, if not the only, one of in a fistful of companies around the world that we can say that we cover the entire 3D environment. So we can go from 3D modeling to 3D inspection to actual 3D printing of an object. So on that regard, yes, in the case of aerospace, we can create, you know, augmented reality environments using 3D information. We can design the interior of the planes. We can scan legacy parts. And then not only that, once you have that 3D model, we can also provide a solution to print and make a physical object of your 3D model.
That's pretty awesome, being able to span the market that much and really add additional value beyond just one point in the chain.
That's the idea. The idea is to offer our customers the complete environment, like I mentioned before. So to take somebody from 3D scan to 3D model, 3D simulation, and 3D printing.
So if any of our listeners want to learn more, how's the best way to get a hold of?
Well, Shining 3D is a company with a global presence. So our headquarter offices are located in Hangzhou, China. And inside of China, we have 13 other offices spread all over the geography of China. Outside of China, we have another office, which is considered the headquarter office for EMEA, or Europe, Middle East, and Africa, in Stuttgart, Germany. And here in the case of the Americas, our headquarter office is located in San Francisco, California. So from there, we take care of all the customers from Canada all the way to Patagonia.
And the website is
Shining3D.com.
So that's Shining3D.com.
Correct.
Oscar, thank you so much for being on the
show.
Brian,
thank you very much for the time. Thank you.
All right, Brian, thanks for those interviews. Really interesting. This is a topic, I think, that has, as we said, big implications for aviation and aerospace in general.
Yeah, and I think it definitely goes beyond what when I first got involved with this, I just thought it was just about printing parts. Mm-hmm. And as we heard from, I think, the breadth of these interviews that I did, it's so much more than that. And it covers so many other aspects within the ecosystem. And again, I hopefully our listeners find it as interesting as I do. And I think that we're only going to hear more and more about this in every aspect of our lives moving forward. This really is the beginning of 3D printing, scanning, additive manufacturing. So it's definitely fun being a part of it, or being part of an industry on the ground floor.
And Brian, I sense something here. I mean, this show has spun off many podcasts in the past. I think I hear the additive manufacturing podcast in the future.
Wow. Not for me. There's probably 30 3D printing additive manufacturing podcasts. No, I'm not going to start a podcast if that's what you were getting at.
Yes, but only one would have Brian on the show.
Yeah, I'm quite happy here. Thank you.
Yeah, I just Googled additive manufacturing podcast, and yeah, there I am seeing quite a few.
Yeah.
All right, one more thing we wanted to do before we close out this episode is we have another submission from student pilot Nikki. This is the fifth part in her episode of becoming a pilot, and this is about her second solo flight. So let's listen to Nikki.
Hello, everyone. Nikki here again. In this recording, I thought I'd talk to you about my second solo. From the point I picked up the clipboard for the aircraft to the point I returned, it was all by myself. The instructor was not involved. He was never actually on the airplane. In fact, he wasn't even at the airport outside of talking to me about the weather. And the weather was the interesting part about this flight. The winds were 10 knots, gusting to 14 out of 6. The runway I took off was 5, so there wasn't much of a crosswind component to it. But it was probably the strongest headwinds I've probably ever taken off into, and I was a little bit nervous about this. The reason why is when walking out to the aircraft, the wind was basically coming from the back of the aircraft, so basically hitting the tail of the airplane head on, and the plane was obviously pointed the opposite direction. So pre-flighting was a little bit of a challenge. And I did something different during my pre-flight. I did the standard, get in the airplane, turn everything on, make sure everything is correct, checked my fuel, checked everything, lowered my flaps, checked my lights. Except this time, when I got checked everything, I turned the aircraft off. I went out and checked all my control surfaces first before doing my entire pre-flight. I don't know if that was 100% correct, but considering the winds were knocking my ailerons and my elevator around, I thought checking them first and then putting the control lock back in so they weren't buffeted or knocked up and down during the rest of the pre-flight was a smart idea. After doing that, I started at my static port like I always do and did my entire pre-flight from all the way around the aircraft. And once I got back into the cockpit, I went ahead and removed the control lock and held the control yoke in place so nothing was getting knocked around. I started the airplane, started my taxi, and I went through all of the my normal pre-ritual things before I got on my taxiway, made sure my radios were set, make sure there was no traffic coming, and I made a mental check of basically how should I use the controls, which way do I need to put my ailerons in my elevator for this wind. Now, if I remember correctly, one of the questions on the FAA exam is what is the worst winds that you could have as a private pilot or as a student pilot. And if I'm correct, they were a quarterly tailwind, which is exactly what I currently had. So I made sure that I always made sure my ailerons and my elevator were always in the correct position during my taxi, because I was during the entire taxi, I was going to have that right quarterly tailwind. During engine run-up, no big deal. Everything happened as usual. Taxied onto the runway, and I took off. Now, remember, I have a 10-knot headwind, almost a 10-knot headwind, gusting to 14. So my climb rate was far higher than I've ever seen in this airplane, and I'm only flying a 172, and typically I see 500, 600 feet a minute, especially with my instructor. Without him, I'm normally around 7 or 8. This time, believe it or not, I was over 1,000. In fact, I was closer to 1,300 feet a minute. And when I saw this, I was like, oh, I'm obviously pulling back too much on the controls. My airspeed's going to be low. And I glanced down. My airspeed was exactly at 80 knots. In fact, it was probably a little over 80 knots. I was like, wow. I honestly wish I had a photo of it. Of course, obviously, I couldn't because I was flying the airplane and I couldn't take out my phone to snap a photo of a 1,300-foot climb rate in my little 172. Continuing on the flight, my crosswind, my first turn on crosswind at 700 feet was a little bit nail-biting because the gust of wind definitely showed itself, which was kind of interesting. Downwind, the plane was far faster than it normally is. Obviously, I had a very nice tailwind, and I was a little nervous about coming on base because I was going to be a little slow. And with such a heavy crosswind, I didn't really know how the plane was going to react. Most planes, in fact, I believe every plane, has a max crosswind component. And, of course, this plane was no different, 14 knots. And, of course, if the wind is gusting to 14 knots, I could be very close to that crosswind component. I didn't know if that was going to have a major factor on my base turn. But I went ahead and made the base turn, kept myself a little fast, made sure to keep an eye on my airspeed indicator, making sure I did not drop anywhere into a critical zone, which I didn't. It just was really crabbed into the wind, and I lowered my left wing just a little bit to make sure I could keep my somewhat turn. Again, on my base turn, I typically have points in the pattern, like a building I typically love to fly over, or a school that I keep just in front of me. So I don't really look at my compasses or anything like that on base turns or even on downwind, just because I like my visual references on the ground. They're far easier to see. Then on final, normally I have my plane around 1700 RPMs. This plane did not want to descend. I think I ended up somewhere around 1000 just to try to get me down on my typical glide slope I like for my final approach. And it was a very interesting landing because of such a headwind. I probably had the smoothest landing I've ever had because the airplane just did not want to settle down on the runway. And once it finally did, it was like, nope, don't want to slow down. Don't want to slow down. I still want to stay in the air. And that was very interesting. And again, always trying to keep in mind, where are my winds? What am I doing? When the plane started slowing down enough, of course, you know, you got to put the controls into the wind so that I don't get pushed off the runway anymore. And as soon as I taxied off the runway, I immediately raised my flaps and made a decision, should I take off again? Again, this is a solo, no flight instructor. And I decided to go ahead and go again. I said it wasn't really that bad. The worst part was my crosswind and my base. And believe it or not, taxing, because I had such a heavy wind. going forward, I completed the entire flight. And I made a note even in my logbook of the winds and everything, and I thought it was very interesting. I seem to have a knack for finding wind conditions and crosswind components. In fact, almost every solo flight I've had thus far has always had something going on with winds, and this was no exception. So I hope you guys liked this little talk about my extraordinary high climb rate and my strong headwinds. So with that being said, this is Nikki signing off, saying always reminding you to check your winds and weather.
Thanks, Nikki.
Max T, I had a question for you. Actually, I had a lot of questions for you on this segment. And I've mentioned before that I teach scuba. And one of the things that I try and teach all my students is if the weather conditions aren't favorable, cancel the dive. You could always come back the next day. With her crosswind being so strong, with the headwinds, and this being her, I believe she said, her second solo flight, do you think that she should have canceled this flight? Or is this actually a good thing for a student to go through and practice? Because she's probably going to come up against these decisions and these conditions in the future.
Well, I didn't hear that the crosswind was particularly severe. I think my recollection was she said the winds were 10 degrees off of the runway heading. So even though the winds were, 10 gusting to 14 or something like that, they were largely down the runway. And so that's not going to be a big deal. In fact, I would say here at Palo Alto, a standard summer afternoon is 15 gusting to 20. Unfortunately, it's always within probably about 20 degrees of the, sometimes 30 degrees of the runway heading. So no, that didn't particularly strike strike me as being an issue.
And the other question was really just, how do you think she's doing and progressing? Is this with all the other recordings, is she on the normal path, going faster than other students, slower than students? Is she coming into the same challenges that every student comes across?
Oh, I think every student has their own unique challenges. So I think she's, finding her way and, figuring out strengths and weaknesses and moving forward with the help of the flight instructor. So, yeah, I would say it's probably normal kind of progress. Now, one comment she made had to do with quartering tailwinds being the most difficult. And that was in the context of taxiing. So I think that usually would be in the context instead of wake turbulence. So the written exam has a question that talks about for wake turbulence avoidance on the runway, which wind is, the worst, and that's a quartering tailwind. But in terms of taxiing, quartering tailwind isn't going to be any more difficult than, wind coming from any other direction. And I will say the comment about the climb rate, that was the thing I still remember 40 plus years ago when I soloed, how shocked I was at how much better the airplane flew when my instructor was out of the airplane. And that's because you remove significant weight and an aircraft suddenly climbs greatly. So I've always remembered to tell each of my clients before they solo, and this is what my instructor didn't tell me. when I climb out, you're going to be shocked at how good the performance of this aircraft is. And if you make a big deal of it, you're in trouble.
All right. Well, we thank Nikki for sending these in. It's kind of fun to stand over the shoulder, if you will, and watch her progress. It's kind of a fascinating process. All right. Well, we're going to wrap this up, but I do want to mention real quick that we received an email from Mauricio who asked, how come you guys didn't comment about the Embraer and Boeing talks? Which is a really good question that I don't have a really good answer for. We were going to try to take a look at that this episode, but I think what we'll do is we'll push that off till next time, maybe cover that in our news segment, especially with the other guys, the full complement of co-hosts, and address it there. So for this episode, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's at airplanegeeks.com/486. Let's tell folks where they can find us online or how to reach us. Brian Coleman, start with you.
Oh, the best place for people to find me next week is actually over in England. The fine folks at Plane Talking UK invited me to participate in their 200th show.
Yes,
so
yes.
Really excited about that.
You're going over for that?
I am. Yeah, going to fly over.
Wow.
And I get to do another evaluation of United. And fortunately, my flight, I've been upgraded on both segments coming and going, so I will get to do a full review on the United Polaris class. So really looking forward to flying on the 787. But more importantly, I'm looking forward to seeing Carlos and Matt again.
Yes.
And their listeners, and they have something really special planned where we're going to go fly a 737. It's in a simulator, but we get to do takeoff and landing in a
yes,
in a 737. So that's going to be my first time. I've flown the space shuttle. I did some work at NASA and was in Houston and was fortunate enough to fly space shuttle. So this is going to be my first time actually flying a 737. So super excited about that and seeing the guys and hanging out with their listeners and all the festivities that they have planned. So that's really special. Other than that, people can get a hold of me by sending an email to brian@airplanegeeks.com. And every once in a while, I actually check into Slack, but I'm really slacking off in doing that.
Yeah, so. You really are.
I am.
So is Max Trescott. But where do folks find you online, Mr. Trescott?
Well, obviously not on Slack.
Yeah.
No. I mean, I am signed in there and I do make it periodically, but holy cow, it's just hard to keep up with all the different social media types. And I find that I spend, more time in some and less in others. And then of course it varies. Yeah.
Yeah. You sort of have to pick your, the one that appeals most to you. And that's different for everybody. Some people live on Twitter. Some people live on Facebook. I'm really enjoying our Slack team.
Yep. and some on Reddit and so on and so forth.
Yes,
so yes. It is impossible to, unless you spent 24/7 on social media, which would create other problems. Like maintaining a marriage.
Right.
Anyway, where can I be found? Well, you can generally find me in Cirrus or near Cirrus, usually at one of the many airports here in the San Francisco Bay Area, unless I'm zooming around the country. And in the online world, look for me at aviationnewstalk.com. And you can just click on contact and send me an email. I'm also on Twitter for Max Truscott. And, of course, you can find me every week on the Aviation News Talk podcast.
Great. And we'll mention, of course, that David Vanderhoof blogs at whatjustflewby.com. And Rob Mark, you can find him at Flying Magazine or at the Jetwine blog. As for me, you can find me occasionally on Twitter at Max Flight. You can also find me on LinkedIn. Also, each week with David Vanderhoof on the UAVDigest.com. And also monthly with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. Well, our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. And our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions where he blends aviation sounds with other music at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.